A man named Robert plied me with a handful of Jack Matthews stories several months ago. And let me tell you that the Express Lane Hove Easy Pass direct way to get me to take interest in a short story writer is to send me a book called something like Crazy Women, and have it stocked with stories about crazy women. And if you really want to get me there, the opening dedication in such a book might read, Crazy Women is dedicated to all those who understand how negotiable and variously ironic the title is. He's one of those writers that makes me glad that I don't yet know all the great writers, but I'm awfully thankful to be one step closer. Thank you, Robert. Good evening. It's Wednesday, the 5th of January, 2011, and it's Miette's Bedtime Story Podcast, A Woman of Properties, by Jack Matthews. It's too hot in here, Mrs. Gressley, wearing a pink pants suit, said. Where's the thermostat? Mr. and Mrs. Davis looked at each other and then looked away. Mr. Cobb, the realtor, stared at his thumbnail. Not hearing her demand answered, Mrs. Gressley decided to ignore the issue. After all, it was not her house yet, and the way she felt at the moment, it just might never be. She told herself she was distinctly less than satisfied, and silently formulated her feelings of the moment in exactly that way. "Well, there's nothing wrong with the insulation," Mr. Cobb said, answering her obliquely. Mrs. Gressley thought a moment, relating this to her complaint about the heat. Then she understood. It was cold outside. Therefore the fact that the house was too hot was meant to indicate that it was not leaking warmth, the way a less well-insulated house might. She sniffed contemptuously at such a shoddy concession to reason. If she had been a real estate person, she thought, she would have attacked the issue forthrightly and won. But of course, if she had been anyone else, she would have agreed with herself as she now was. Any other option for a sensible person was unthinkable. And here's the porch, Mr. Cobb said, waving his open hand vaguely toward the rear. It was a sloppy gesture, for if it had been meant seriously, he would have been calling the television set the porch. Mr. Cobb was a short, fat man, with light caramel-coloured skin and bushy white sideburns. He bore a reproachful, startled expression that Mrs. Gressley found utterly ludicrous. He complained of a stuffy nose twice already. When he walked, his head glided like that of a man coasting on a bicycle. He was informed, but feckless. "That's true," Mrs. Davis said, nodding. "The house is pretty well insulated." Mrs. Gressley turned and stared at her a minute, wondering how she could respond to something so belatedly. Mrs. Davis was thin and young, with straggly, pale hair. She wore a faded green wool serape and seemed to have a head cold too. Mrs. Gressley decided that Mrs. Davis was not only lacking in energy, but also not very bright, like a lot of women her age. But of course that couldn't be helped. And anyway, it wasn't any of Mrs. Gressley's business yet. Mrs. Gressley didn't meddle in things that were not, strictly speaking, her business. And at the moment it wasn't certain whether or not this house would be her business or not. She had a checkbook in her purse, and if she decided she wanted it, she could write out a check for Mr. Cobb right away. A binder for the whole kit and caboodle. And then it happened. Just before stepping out onto the back porch, Mrs. Gressley smelled pipe tobacco. She paused and sniffed audibly. Twice, three times. She did not say anything, but she trusted that her displeasure was fully communicated. She also decided, at that moment, to buy this house, just so that she could work at evicting the Davises. Because there was no doubt about it. He was a pipe smoker, and she would not tolerate the odour of tobacco in any house she owned. Not for long, she wouldn't. The back porch was lofty, and looked out over a ravine. Since the house was situated on a steep hill, the door at ground level in back led directly into the basement. Mrs. Gressley had come in through the basement, liking to take houses by surprise. Mr. Cobb had followed her, sniffing and mumbling real estate clichés at her back. Now, astride some invisible Bucephalus, Mrs. Gressley gazed out upon her ravine and found it distasteful. It had the look of being used too much. She knew the sort of place, dirty plastic food wrappers floating in the muddy water of the creek and boys with dirt-smeared legs playing with war toys in the underbrush. Also a variety of beer bottles and pop cans festering in the pale grass. "How do you spell your name?" Slowly Mrs. Gressley turned and saw Mr. Davis standing there behind her, puffing on his pipe. The pipe. He had just lit it, and the stink of tobacco filtered out past her shoulder into the soft evening air toward the maple trees by the garage. "What was that?" she asked. Mr. Davis nodded, as if he'd expected her not to understand. "I'm interested in names," he said. "Surnames. It's my field." "He's a professor at the university," Mr. Cobb said lugubriously. "Professor Davis." "Call me Gary," Professor Davis said, pulling heavily on his pipe. For a moment, Mrs. Gressley seemed confused. She had not been prepared for such a question. Nobody ever asked about her name, but there was a very interesting story behind her name. She didn't quite like the idea of somebody like this Gary Davis, who was awfully young to call himself a professor, she thought, asking an interesting question. But she couldn't refuse an answer, so she lifted her chin and said, "It was my husband's name, of course, and originally it was Swiss. It was spelled G-R-O-E-S-T-L-I, Grossley, as a condition for marriage into an old American family named Perkins. He was reputed to have said that his wife was well worth the sacrifice. She was said to have had a lovely singing voice, a ravishing creature. I often advised my husband to change it back to the old world spelling, but he wouldn't listen to me. None of my business, I suppose." Mrs. Gressley ended her explanation with a harsh laugh. "Your husband has passed away, then?" Mr. Davis asked politely, raising his eyebrows. Mrs. Gressley gave a hollow laugh at such an impudent question. "That's the precise term for it," she said ambiguously. "Passed away. Not necessarily dead, mind you, but passed away." She said this as if there might be some obscure connection between his refusal to restore the original spelling of his name and his absence at the moment. Mr. Cobb stamped his foot on the porch. "Solid as a rock," he said. "Solid oak. Double flooring, even out here on the porch. They don't build them like this anymore. Solid as a rock." At that moment, for no apparent reason, Mrs. Gressley was filled with a sudden, wrathful intolerance, and she fastened upon poor Mr. Cobb's locution. Why did they always say solid as a rock? A needlessly anguished voice cried out in her head. Why didn't they say as solid as a noodle, or as solid as a party boat, or as solid as a week of Sundays? Mrs. Gressley burrowed deeper into the house. She was not one to waste a dollar, and, as anybody could tell you, She knew real estate inside and out. She had 6 houses in town already, and this would make the 7th. She kept tight records and knew where every penny went. She knew the price of Venetian blinds and cement block. She knew where to get roofing nails at a bargain price, and had 40 squares of unused roofing shingles stored over a double garage on Poplar Street, just waiting for the first complaint about a leaky roof. The Davises began to lag behind, and finally drifted off. That was as it should be. Mr. Cobb trailed along after her, jabbering about the house, as if anything he might ever say would influence her one way or the other. She was one person who would buy or not buy. She would not be sold. Especially by anybody as dopey as Mr. Cobb, who talked like he had his mind on other things. Mrs. Grusley descended to the basement, whence she'd come. She heard Mr. Cobb's feet pattering down the steps behind her. The basement smelled of dampness and old truck tires. She hated such smells. Turning left, behind the furnace, she was brought up sharp by the sight of a full-length mirror that the Davises had stored there. Face out, for some incomprehensible reason. It showed her in an unflattering light, in spite of the darkness. The mirror made her look shorter and dumpier than she really was. It made her pantsuit pinker. It made her head look bigger than necessary, not to mention her hands and shoes. Her shoes looked enormous, and yet she had to admit they fit snug enough. She walked as if she were stamping out little fires, and knew it very well, but some things can't be helped. She heard Mr. Cobb breathing behind her right shoulder. For once he was not trying to explain things for her benefit. She gazed into the slanted mirror, leaning against the dirty wall, and then heard him say, "Mirror." She turned and placed a glance of utter disgust upon him, but he didn't seem to notice. Instead, he took a nasal inhaler out of his pocket and prodded it up his nostril. She could smell it, and had to admit that it was better than tobacco smoke, but not much. While he was intent upon sniffing the inhaler, she brushed past him, headed for another part of the basement. Her contempt for him was impossible to conceal, even though she doubted he would ever notice anything. He wasn't the type. The fact was, he had no idea whatsoever of why she needed to buy this house, and wasn't even aware that she was going to get it, no matter what he might say about it. Furious gabber that she could also be upon occasion, she nevertheless held this secret to her breast, and nourished it. The secret reason had to do with Clyde Brickle, the owner of this house. Like Mrs. Grusley, Clyde Brickle was also an owner of properties. He owned Brickle's Hardware, where he spent most of his time and energy, but he also owned a double on Mill Street and 4 student rooming houses in the east end of town. There was something about a farm in Carthage Township, too, but Mrs. Grusley was a little vague about this. Why Clyde Brickle wanted to sell this house she was now in was beyond understanding. The instant she'd heard about it, she'd wondered, for she knew it was in good repair, but just to make sure she'd phoned Ansa Tober and checked with him, along with Becky Thurman at the courthouse. She'd pushed all the buttons, and they'd all flashed green for go-ahead, which left Clyde Brickle's role in the whole business unclear. Not that Mrs. Grusley didn't love a mystery, but she preferred the kind that were clear and above board. This was something a little different, and if she'd been the type, she would have been uneasy. As it was, however, she knew from the instant she'd heard about it that she had to get this house from Clyde Brickle. In spite of the little games of indecision she'd played with herself, there had never been any doubt. Nobody else would have this house. There was nothing she'd let stop her. Mrs. Grustley took pride in the conviction that she never lied to herself, and she wasn't about to start lying in a matter as crucial as this. Clyde Brickle's wife had died last summer, and maybe his selling the house had to do with that. Maybe he was going to liquidate all his holdings in town, including the hardware store, and move to Arizona. The thought of this was like a brick in Mrs. Grustley's stomach. She wanted to be victorious over Clyde Brickle. She didn't want him to escape. It was that simple. But how simple was that? The answer was complicated, but it had to do with the fact that Clyde Brickle and Mrs. Grustley, whose name had then been Emily Fogle, had once dated in high school. It had been Clyde Brickle who had taken her maidenhead one Friday night in the back seat of his father's Packard, after the game with Harrisburg. Mrs. Grustley would never forget that moment, as what woman would? But the fact was, or seemed to be, that Clyde Brickle had forgotten. Or, even more unsettling, it appeared that for Clyde, the whole business hadn't even taken place, as if it had been her own personal illusion in which Clyde Brickle had played a part as a sort of animated lover, an incubus, or whatever they were called. Because not after that, to her, momentous happening, Clyde had eloped with Jenny Deems, and when the two of them returned a week later, Emily Fogle, who would some day become Mrs. Grustley, might just as well have been a lamp post or fire plug, so far as Clyde Brickle was concerned. Jenny Deems, as Mrs. Clyde Brickle, got twin boys and a daughter out of him, not to mention one of the finest houses in town and yearly visits to Arizona, where Clyde's older brother owned a department store. All Mrs. Grustley got was Mr. Grustley. And the most interesting thing about him was his name, which he'd disavowed anyway, so far as the spelling went. The second most interesting thing about Mr. Grustley, however, was that he'd left her, passed away. After his departure, Mrs. Grustley fancied that he might have been more interesting than she really knew he was for all those years, but she didn't dwell on such speculations long, for she was not a woman to fool herself. The old wall between the living room and dining room had been knocked out, giving an effect of spaciousness to the first floor. The Davises, for all their untidy ways, had shown good taste in furnishing it, although it was too dark, especially now, without a single lamp burning. And there were long, shaggy green plants hanging from wicker baskets and bright red and green wall pieces on the dark inner panelling. The legs of a huge